Well, could I say welcome to everybody at this European Institute lecture this evening. And in particular, let me welcome our guest speaker, Dennis McShane, who, as we all know, is Minister for Europe. In an earlier life, I think it's fair to say, Dennis was a BBC producer, and he was also the head man for the National Union of Journalists. And in addition to that, he has really published a great deal about things European, and I think things international. More recently, he has been and is an MP. He was elected for Rotherham in 1994. And Parliamentary Private Secretary to Foreign Office Ministers from June 1997 to June 2001. And from October 2002, has been Minister for Europe. And his field of responsibilities includes a very wide range, the CFSP, Common Foreign and Security Policy, Eastern Adriatic, the Economic Policy Department, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and the Council of Europe Department. We're extremely grateful to him for sparing the time to with us this evening. He will answer questions at the end of his speech. So we look forward very much to hearing your remarks, Dennis.
Well, thank you, Paul, and good evening, everybody. Now, I thought of doing this speech in German just to kind of tease all the Eurosceptics who are here, but I think I'd better not. Actually, it's a secret of the government. I trust there are no journalists here, so put away your pens. And I'm going to reveal to you now, because the Prime Minister speaks very, very good French, and increasingly he is holding cabinet meetings in French. And it really does make for very, very good government. Because there is one person who speaks, there is one person who understands, and Gordon Brown issues translations if he really thinks it's helpful. But I'll try and talk tonight in English, that well-known European language. Now, 14 years ago, in 1989, Europe dissolved from the stolidity of the post-1945 settlement and became a continent in which too much history was being made too quickly. Economic and political life has not settled down, neither in Britain nor in the rest of Europe. The US Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, caused a stir earlier this year when he talked of old and new Europe. By that, I think he meant a geographical division, or one based on positions taken over the Iraq conflict. Poland, as a nation, sees its constituent date, in the sense of Poland declaring itself a nation, as being in 966, a full century before the French colonized England. So, if anything, the new nations of Europe are its oldest members. And I want to put it to you tonight for discussion that the real division between old and new Europe is one of visions and values, between a 20th century vision of a European Union that was statist, régalien, to use the French term, régalien, elitist, rather self-satisfied and centralized, and the new 21st century values of a European Union based on networks, nations, cities and citizens, open and willing to learn. The old Europe, if you like, was Jacobin. The new Europe will be Girondin. I hope all of them, Paul, know their French revolutionary history. Good man, good man, good man. The old argument between so-called federalists and so-called nation firsters between, if you like, a Europe of Spark and a Europe of de Gaulle belongs to the history books. But the old Europe is not yet dead, and the new Europe is struggling to be born. And as someone once said, in the intervening period, there is much confusion and uncertainty. What is clear is that for the first time since the Congress of Vienna, Britain can play a central part in the shaping of Europe. And we do so by the sovereign decisions of the British people, who in 1997 and in 2001 rejected the isolationism of those who say that Britain should not be playing a leading role in Europe. On the contrary, we should be in Europe and running Europe. Now, Churchill famously remarked to de Gaulle that if our country had to choose between the continent and the oceans, we would always choose the latter. But the empire has gone, and it was Churchill himself who made this point when he launched the movement to greater European integration in his famous Zurich speech of 1946, calling for a United States of Europe. It was Churchill who first gave real popularity to that phrase. I've just been reading the diaries of Harold Macmillan for the 1950s, and it's amazing to see how keen the then Conservative Party was on building up Europe. So many of the issues that worry us today are old themes from the 1950s. Macmillan noted, for example, that people feared isolationism, or, it's a very ugly word coming up, Asialanism. Oh, I can't even pronounce it. Asialationism in America. In other words, America will be looking towards Asia. I think Asialationism is what he means. I've never heard of it before. But it's very interesting when you hear a lot of theoreticians talking today in seminars and conferences that the trouble with America is it's forgetting about Europe and it's looking towards the West Coast and Asia. Here is Harold Macmillan coining this ugly word, Asialationism, in parallel with isolationism, as a great fear that he had of the United States position 50 years ago. And he also noted how keen the French were on, and I quote, a European army as a guarantee against German military domination of Europe. Now, I quote Harold Macmillan not to indicate agreement, but to highlight that the European question has to be seen from different vantage points and, above all, set in a historical context, because those who forget history are condemned to repeat it. And I'm amazed at the amnesia of those in our own country who have forgotten what ills have befallen our nation when we disengage from shaping Europe and fall into the trap that island isolationism is a sensible policy for the British people. I became Minister for Europe exactly 1 year ago, and I decided I would spend as much time in the other capitals of Europe, please note the deliberate use of the plural, in order to promote British thinking and policy, and to learn for myself the direction that Europe wanted and needed to go. And in a sense, this is a progress report to you after 1 year of this work. I think in the past, the old Europe that I believe today is making way for the new Europe was, frankly, too focused on Brussels. I read a headline in that excellent Belgian newspaper, Le Soir, the other day, which read, "Plus d'Europe, plus de bâtiments à Bruxelles." More Europe means more buildings in Brussels. Well, I don't see the European Union as simply a helping hand for the Belgian construction industry. Yet the notion of Brussels as the federal district of Europe, the DC of Europe, belongs to the 20th century concept of the European Union. The idea of a European federal superstate is over, dead, covered in garlic with a stake through its heart. Now, there may be some Dracula politicians who need to keep threatening the children with the vision of a European federal superstate, but they do so more to cheer up their own anti-European supporters than because they believe it is going to happen. And one of the fundamental dishonesties about British political discourse in Europe is the refusal to discuss European reality rather than to whip up populist fears by making extravagant claims about what Europe is about to do. Like Glendower in Henry IV, the anti-Europeans pretend to call up spirits from the vasty deep. And I suppose, like Hotspur and other Europe ministers, I have to say, yes, but will they come when you call them? That the cold truth is that these fearful imaginings exist in the recesses of the anti-European psyche and are not based on reality. Take, for example, the present discussion on the EU constitutional treaty currently being discussed at the Intergovernmental Conference. The draft text, put forward after 18 months' discussion by parliamentarians from the House of Commons and other European parliaments, ministers, MEPs, commission people, that discussion on the Convention of the Future of Europe should be called, or the outcome of it should be called, the British Constitution, said Robert Badinter, the former French Justice Minister and, frankly, Europe's leading constitutional legal expert. Monsieur Badinter made his arguments because he said the text was thoroughly impregnated with British empiricisms, ideas and common sense values. But to read the reports in our anti-European press with lurid headlines like Blueprint for Tyranny or the end of 1,000 years of British sovereignty was to go straight through the looking glass into the world of anti-Europeans where everything is distorted to make the facts fit the myths of anti-European ideology. Some of the scare stories were absolutely wonderful. The crowned heads of Europe would lose their status, wrote a lot of papers. And I thought to myself, the King of Spain, the King of Sweden, the Queen of the Netherlands, the King of the Belgium, the Queen of Denmark, our own queen, suddenly been woken up early one morning with that, ici Bruxelles, guten Tag, buenos dias, es Bruxelles aquí. I have a call for you, Your Majesty. You're going to lose your crown. We're going to come along later this afternoon to measure up the curtains. President Chirac is a head of state too. I think it'll be a surprise to him to read our anti-European press to hear the heads of state of Europe are to be knocked off under the constitutional treaty. And then there was a wonderful story saying that Nelson would be removed from the top of Nelson's column to be replaced by Napoleon. I thought it was going to be replaced by Ken Livingstone, but I mean there was a... and then the even better one, that under the constitutional treaty, Britain could be forced to start driving on the right. Of course, it would be introduced on a staggered basis, but I mean, we would get used to it over time. I just don't know what world these people live in. Britain and France would lose their seats on the UN Security Council. Britain and French nuclear weapons would be under the control of the European Parliament. British and, by implication, French and German constitutional arrangements would be superseded by an all-powerful European legal system. Overnight, the German constitution, the French constitution, would crumble away to be replaced by diktats from Brussels. And I just have a simple test. Would a mass-selling newspaper in Paris or Berlin or anywhere else, Rome or the Netherlands, publish such scare stories and maintain credibility in other capitals? I don't think so, yet it is taken for granted that we should wake up each morning to such fairy tales. Well, the British people are wiser than their editors and their anti-European politicians. Again and again, they have rejected the party offering to stand on a Eurosceptic manifesto. They said no to my party, the Labour Party of the 1980s, when we were hostile to Europe, and they said no massively in 1997 and 2001 to the Eurosceptic Conservatives. And I'm delighted that on present evidence, Michael Howard wants to maintain the Conservative Party as the main Euro-hostile party in British politics. His old Cambridge friend, Lord Lamont, recently compared the Convention's draft treaty to something from the Third Reich. I read Lord Lamont's extremist language in the Daily Telegraph, and I wonder if that fine Tory newspaper realised what damage they do to the cause of Tory Euroscepticism by printing such lurid extreme language. If I, as a Labour politician, chose something I didn't like, another country or a proposal, and called it Nazi or Third Reich, I would be hounded out of office. Yet such extremist language is permissible when we are discussing Europe. It does no credit to our politics and still less credit to our journalism. And a key test of Mr. Howard's claim that he wants to move his party to the centre will be to see if he drops anti-EU obsessives from his front bench, and whether he drops the late appeal from Jimmy Goldsmith, enshrined, of course, in the very name of his party, the Referendum Party, now succeeded by the UKIP Party. Their call, supported by all the EU withdrawalists in British politics, for a referendum on the European Union's future rulebook. Of course, there are proposals in the draft text for the constitutional treaty that the UK wants to change, but so do many other of the EU's 25 nation states. Each is sovereign, each is democratic, each is proud of its independence, none more so than the nations recently out of communist tyranny. The notion that they are all conspiring to suck Britain into a federal superstate is palpably absurd, and yet such absurdities are commonplace in our discussion on Europe. I've been surprised, pleasantly surprised, on how many issues Britain is one of many, part of a major majority group of EU member states that wants changes in the Giscard text, mainly, though not exclusively, to uphold national authority in key areas. And I am confident that we will bring back to the country and to Parliament a new constitutional treaty which will strengthen the role of our national institutions. Britain is also in the majority of EU member states in resisting a call for a referendum. Instead, I believe we should uphold parliamentary democracy. Britain is signatory to many international treaties, and this will be one more international treaty in which we relinquish part of our national legal sovereignty in order to gain the wider strength of rule of law applied across national borders. I am elected by the voters of Rotherham to uphold parliamentary democracy and to legislate in the interests of my constituents. I'm not at all surprised that the Rothermere Press, which in the 1930s was an open admirer of the plebiscite system used by populist and unscrupulous politicians to undermine parliamentary democracy, should now be campaigning for a referendum. I am surprised, however, the party of Churchill, Macmillan, Thatcher and Major, which always rejected any call for any referendum on international treaties, including the Single European Act and the Maastricht Treaty, which on any judgment involved a much greater sharing of sovereignty than is proposed under the forthcoming Treaty of Rome, should now have abandoned parliamentary democracy for the plebiscite route. If Michael Howard really wants to move to the centre, he will have to drop the anti-EU ramp of the Rothermere Press and uphold the British tradition of making Parliament the centre of our national decision-making process. Because, I put it to you, the people are tired of the long decade that began with the Maastricht Treaty and is still going on, of endless debate about constructing a single, united European political space or identity. Instead, I believe, the citizens of Europe want the European Union to return to its Jean Monnet roots of being a material project aiming at delivering jobs, good wages, and the chance to lead a decent, fulfilling life. It was Hegel, I believe, who noted that out of the crooked timber of humanity, nothing straight was ever constructed. Can we not learn that Europe is not architecture, but something living and changing all the time? Once the present intergovernmental conference is over, can Europe close the files of the nation firsters and the federalists and get back to the high-quality economic growth that transformed Europe between the Berlin airlift and the fall of the Berlin Wall? That new Europe will be defined by its ability to answer the issue of the growing economic gap between the European Union and the United States. Between 1993 and 2002, the European Union's growth managed on average 2.4% a year compared to 3.3% for the US. Anyone who used to do mental maths, familiar with compound interest, will realize that means an ever-widening gap between EU wealth creation and US wealth creation. The wealth gap between the EU and the United States today is already $2 trillion or euros. Very roughly, the US produces $10 trillion of wealth a year. The EU produces $8 trillion. According to the Foreign Office, by 2010, that wealth gap on present trends will be 40%, $14 trillion of GDP for the US, $10 trillion for us in Europe. If current trends continue and the EU fails to grasp the nettle of economic reform to improve productivity, raise skill levels, and generate higher future growth, then this gap will only widen further. Not British arguments. According to France's Institute of International Relations, if Europe growth potters along at its current low levels, then by 2050, Europe, and I quote, will have exited the world stage as a serious economic and political actor. The IMF chief economist said last year, if Europe wanted to see growth in the near future, it would have to watch television. Now, all these points were highlighted in the Sapir report, Professor Sapir's report presented to the European Commission in the summer. It seems to have fallen into a black hole of Brussels oblivion. Frankly, I think Mr. Prodi should worry less about more power for Brussels and worry more about more jobs for Europe. The United States has higher total employment rates and higher productivity per employee. The total employment rate in the US is almost 10% higher than the EU. Total productivity rates in the US are 20% higher than EU productivity per worker. Disincentives to women, to older workers, workers with disabilities being able to take employment if they so wish to in Europe need now, as a matter of political urgency, to be removed. Returning work to the working class should be a priority for the trade union movement in Europe, my family, as Paul indicates, where I come, and a priority for all who care for social justice. One can list all the nominal social rights one would like in an EU constitution or in national law, but if workers are not at work, their social power is undermined and their trade union strength is reduced to union leaders giving press conferences. And that is why Gordon Brown is right to insist that the new Europe must embrace the high productivity, high employment road to wealth creation. But we need to take this message to Europe, we need to take it, make it in Europe, and we need to persuade our partners, not just ourselves. The Prime Minister sought to do this in the excellent article he co-authored with the Estonian Prime Minister on tax harmonisation in the Financial Times on Monday, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer has been spreading the word at ECOFIN today. But we need to do more. All UK ministers should be arguing the case for European reform in Europe. And that is why I hope we can end the IGC quickly on the basis of the amendments to the draft Giscard text upholding unanimity in areas like tax, treaty change, own resources, as well as foreign policy and defence, where Britain and nations wanting to build a new Europe are standing firm, and return European energies to helping the citizens of Europe to have jobs, incomes, and thus allow government fiscal receipts to spend on the good things Europe wants to do. So to build the new Europe, we have to make Europe home to the world's knowledge revolution. We are living with the strains of massive changes in our economy, no longer based, as economies have been up to only a very short period ago, on land and industry. The race to be the locus of the world's knowledge revolution is now on, and Europe needs to play to its strengths. As we know, the idea of university, of a university, was invented in Europe. But today, Europe's universities are losing their clout. According to the OECD, the United States invests 2.3% of its GDP in universities. In Britain, France, and Germany, the figure is 1.1%. In Britain, according to Chris Patten, the new Chancellor of Oxford University, only two universities would win a place in the list of America's top 150 universities in terms of endowment income. So the British have a golden opportunity to take a lead in Europe and begin to match the US investment by supporting the government's proposals, now under discussion, aimed at getting more private money into our universities. Relying on the taxpayers of my constituency of Rotherham, most of whose children do not go to university, is not enough. Now, it's obviously for my colleagues and the education ministers to discuss how the correct balance can be found between ensuring that higher education is properly funded by the state, but with affordable payments made by graduates once they are earning. And we also need to ensure access for bright young students from poorer backgrounds. But from my point of view of being Minister for Europe, I welcome any country that is prepared to reform university finance so that we can match or exceed the best of America and make Europe a world centre for the new knowledge economy. Now, some of my best friends are professors. I can see one or two in the audience tonight. And I'm always amazed, Paul, at how they put up with such low salaries. 35%. Can we have a round of applause at that stage for the professors? Thank you. Oh, God, they're all here. 35% lower than their equivalents in the United States, according to the AUT, the University Professors Union. If I were negotiating for them, and I used to be a union negotiator, I would be campaigning for current government proposals in order to get more money into the university sector, because more money in university means bigger wages for professors. Let's hear it for bigger wages for professors. Good. I'm glad you're all supporters of Charles Clark's top-up fees proposals. We also need a step change in Europe in terms of our approach to science. Between 1900 and 1921, France obtained 18.3% of all the Nobel Prizes in science, and the United States obtained 3.3% of the Nobel Prizes. Between 1980 and last year, this year, 2003, the United States won 57.9% of all Nobel Prizes in science, and France won 2.6%. The number of Nobel Prizes in science for Germany went down by 2/3, and in Britain for half, compared to the beginning of the century and the last 20 years of the century. In short, Europe, which once revered scientists like Louis Pasteur and Marie Curie, now cowers before the anti-science peasant Pujadism of a José Bové, or the superstitions of those who reject nuclear energy as part of our energy matrix. Too many of our best brains go across the Atlantic because they there have access to funding. Too many of tomorrow's Nobel Prize winners from China, India, Korea do their PhDs in North America and stay there to contribute to that region's growing wealth disparity in relation to Europe. Too many of our companies are moving some or all of their research, including the vital business of patent registration, to the United States. Europe is debating itself to death on its constitution, when what we should be doing is smashing through the barriers to create great and properly funded universities in Europe and effective mechanisms to win economic benefits from the knowledge revolution. These are tasks for the new Europe. Another challenge to face up to after the IGC is over is the need to reform the EU budget. It is absurd that the EU's budget of 100 billion euros is spent, 80% of the EU budget of 100 billion euros is spent in just two areas, agricultural protectionism and regional aid. This may have been justified 40 years ago when Europe needed self-sufficiency in food production, or even 20 years ago when the devastation wrought to parts of Britain by bad economic policies so reduced standards of living that South Yorkshire or Merseyside became so poor they became eligible for help from Brussels. But in the 21st century, a new Europe cannot be based on old and counterproductive budget arrangements. I'm glad to see that Ireland, for example, is now supporting decoupling of agricultural support. And again, we have to take the argument for CAP reform to those countries still wedded to protectionist subsidies. But we can only do that as a nation, as a government, if we are fully engaged in Europe. We also need to divert European aid to the new member states of the EU so that their citizens feel they have a stake in their own economies and societies. Another big question to deal with for the new Europe is what relationship to have with the United States. Of course, the question can be posed the other way around. You remember the famous story of Dr. Henry Kissinger when he was appointed National Security Advisor to President Nixon, and the CBS did a documentary program on him. They interviewed his brother for about an hour to use the usual one-minute snatch. And at the end of the hour's interview, they said to him, but Mr. Kissinger, you arrived in America the same time as Henry from Germany, or just a year or two aged apart from him, and yet you speak English or American with a normal American accent. How come Henry still sounds like, you know, a German? And Kissinger's brother said, well, that was always Henry's problem. He was always talking and never listening. And so I think we have to listen to America, but I think the United States has to listen to Europe as well. Because some of the language used in this debate seems designed more to irritate than provide analysis of clear lines and policy. View of Tony Blair, Jack Straw, myself, I think the vast majority of ministers and Labour MPs is clear. We see Europe as a partner for the core values that animate the people of America, irrespective of the administration in office. Chancellor Schröder has said he is against the concept of a Gegenpol, an antipol, arguing there can only be one pole in the world, that of freedom and democracy. He is right. It was a Chinese communist, I think, in the 1950s who invented the concept of multipolarity, and the references to a multipolar world seem to hark back to 19th century spheres of concepts, of spheres of influence, or the disasters of the 20th century bloc mentality in foreign policy. But the best way I'd put it to you that Europe can become an effective partner to the United States is for us to develop our economic strength and to make sense of our disparate, overlapping, and poorly coordinated defense capabilities. Europe needs to spend its more money more effectively on defense, and I welcome, for example, the commitment of Spain and France to increase defense spending. But even without higher defense expenditure, it should be possible for the EU to redesign its military profile to overcome the proliferation of competing weaponry and systems. That is the real challenge, again, for the IGC, to send out a message of strength to the world about Europe's commitment to NATO and to making European security and defence policy work. We need more flexible forces in Europe able to do work on the ground, not new operational headquarters buildings in Brussels rivaling NATO. Because far from America being a hyperpower, as the former French Foreign Minister Hubert Védrine argued, I wonder if it wouldn't be better to see the United States as being more vulnerable than at any time in her history. 50 years ago, America was far richer relative to the rest of the world than today. Pearl Harbor took place thousands of miles from mainland America. 9/11 killed more in an hour than Hitler's bombs managed in a month of the London Blitz. America looks east and sees a challenge of China and other rising Asian powers. It looks south and sees the narco-terrorism of the FARC and ALN in Colombia sending drugs to kill young American boys and girls. It looks at nuclear proliferation threats in North Korea and Iran and sees new worries. It looks at the flashpoints of Kashmir or the occupied territories of the West Bank and sees only seething hatreds which express themselves in a vicious, violent anti-Americanism. America looks at the hatred of all those who demand the destruction of the State of Israel and the strident anti-Americanism, which is a political cultural norm in much of the European intelligentsia and much of the Muslim world. It looks west and sees a growing European Union, which has very different perspectives on Kyoto, the death penalty, trade policy, and indeed uses its clout to stop American companies from merging or erecting tariff barriers to trade in steel. The United States sees its economy dependent on the rest of the world lending it money, financing the deficit, to use economic speak. And even then, 3 million jobs evaporate in as many years, causing distress in heartland U.S. cities. America knows that the resulting imbalances have to be unwound somehow, to use the economic jargon. We Europeans have an interest in ensuring this happens in a coherent way without sudden swings in exchange rates and capital flows. If a US adjustment, for example, takes place through a huge depreciation of the dollar, Europe will be the first to suffer. And the day that America brings all its troops home from Iraq, the Balkans, Europe, Korea, and elsewhere, Will Europeans feel any safer? The greater danger, surely, is a reversion to US isolationism in a modern form, the policy of America in the 1920s and 30s. That is why Tony Blair is right to argue for Europe to remain engaged with America. And the failure of Europe to stand united against Saddam was just that, a failure. Europe as a whole sent the wrong message at the wrong time, in the wrong way, to the wrong people. Saddam thought a divided Europe would protect him. And Americans wondered if the half century of supporting European unity from Truman to both Bushes was a good investment. Well, I think we're moving forward now. European soldiers from 11 EU member states are now playing their part in Iraq. And despite the terrible attacks of the fascist terrorist organizations left behind, the plain fact is that schools are opening in Iraq, newspapers are being published, trade unions are being formed, and politics is on the way. And the notion we should turn the clock back to 500,000 Iraqi children dying in hospitals because Saddam was diverting money for his own purposes, turn the clock back to 300,000 people filling the mass graves of Iraq, tortured, killed, blown up to bits by Saddam's torture police. The notion we should go back to that world is not one I think will make any sense to any Iraqi. I know opinion polls here in my country still express a lot of concern, but every opinion poll in Iraq says, not Yankee go home, but American and European and other soldiers stay here, give us the security to let us escape from the shadow of 25 years of fascist tyranny. And don't forget, Baathism was a political ideology directly inherited and based on European fascist thinking. The foreign ministers today, or this week, of Britain, France and Germany, or last week, travelled jointly to Iran to deliver a united message from Europe that we will not accept nuclear proliferation on our doorstep. When Europe stands united and says the same thing in the same way to the same people, then we begin to have clout. Europe needs to give its full support to the EU ambitions of Turkey in the interests of Turkey, Europe and the Eastern Mediterranean. This EU support must be extended to resolving that long-standing blight on Europe's unity, the division of Cyprus. 3 years into the 21st century, Nicosia remains the last divided capital in Europe. The European Union needs to do all it can to promote a just, viable and comprehensive settlement into the Cyprus problem ahead of the island joining the EU next May. And Turkey, for its part, needs to send a clear message to the Turkish Cypriot community that the UN Secretary General's plan, the so-called Annan plan, is the only realistic basis for such a settlement. Negotiations should resume as soon as possible so that it is a united rather than a divided Cyprus that enters the EU next May. Europe, I believe, needs to sharpen up its Balkans policy. Chancellor Schroeder has made an important visit to the region this week, underlining the need for the Western Balkans to look to Europe. We need to move forward on Kosovo so that standards and status are discussed and the people of the region accept their responsibilities rather than assuming the UN will be forever present. But in all these issues, the two great regions of democracy and rule of law in the world, that's to say the European Union and the United States, must act as partners. The Gaullist vision of hostility to the United Nations and the Gaullist hostility to the need for supranational rule of law must be overcome. We all need to learn to speak Volapük, to use de Gaulle's contemptuous dismissal of the language of international treaties and post-national cooperation and rule of law. As Tony Blair argues again and again, the best answer to unilateralism is partnership, the best response to 9/11 is solidarity, the best answer to the difficulties in Iraq is to get stuck in to help the Iraqi people. In the process of constructing Europe, I have long argued this cannot be done without France or against France, without Germany or against Germany, without Spain or against Spain, and indeed without Britain or against Britain. Similarly, a safer, fairer world will not be built without or against the United States. And for 9 years now as an MP, and now more recently as a minister, I have had to do political battle in Britain against anti-Europeanism. Europe needs to combat anti-Americanism as both anti-Europeanism and anti-Americanism are twin forces of the politics of negativity that will take us nowhere. Jean Monnet was once asked if he was optimistic or pessimistic about the future of Europe. He replied, "Neither. I am determined." And it is that determination to strengthen British interests by making a safe, secure and prosperous Europe that should be at the heart of any British policy towards our common continent. Because Europe will never be under the domination of one or two or even three countries. The Europe of 25, shortly 27, maybe more soon, will be based on networks. It will be based on cities. It will be based on different companies and people living and operating across national borders. Excuse me. I'm just recovering from a flu. It will divide into two biggish groups, not old and new, but rather EU member states that embrace reform, create the new economy, and are open to the world, in contrast to those that think Europe should be based on the acquis of the status quo and protect out-of-date arrangements such as the common agricultural policy. Britain must be at the head of the Europe of change and reform and modernization, the Europe of permanent reformism, the Europe of movida, to use a Spanish expression, not an Europe portiflade or a Europe of stillstand. At some stage, I hope, British politics will stop tearing itself apart over Europe. We should be in Europe and helping to run Europe, in Europe and shaping Europe. Britain always makes a mistake when it turns its back on Europe. And today, our new partners in the enlarged Europe need and want Europe to be active in Europe. Unlike the 1930s, we will not let them down. We will shape a new Europe in which membership of the European Union adds value to what nations do, and nations willingly and freely share sovereignty to allow Europe to do best what is best done at the European level. And it will be a new Europe because the old Europe has run out of steam. Today's generation of people leaving universities have a chance without precedent in the 2,500 years of European history. My parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, grew up in a Europe where, save in one or two countries, life was brutish, nasty, and brutal, nasty, and short. Where whole countries like Ireland and Norway, Portugal, virtually had to send every second male to emigration to earn and live make a living. Where people had to flee to Romania and open dress shops in South Wales, such was the oppression and tyranny they grew up in, where wars and conflicts and civil disturbances, where religious hates were the norm. That was the norm of Europe until very recently. We will not go back there by allowing the European Union to break up into competing zones of national differences and divisions. And it's to build a continent of peace and prosperity, of rule of law and social justice, of cooperating internationally under enforceable rules that is a challenge for the generation that is going over the next half century to grow and lead in Europe. It's to show by example and self-discipline and tolerance that different nations, religions, cultures, ethnicities and beliefs can coexist rather than dream of the hope of national or religious or ideological supremacy. It is an enormous challenge, to be sure, but it's the world I want to live in. It's the world I want my children to live in. Welcome to the new Europe. It is yours to build.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Dennis, for that inspirational talk. He's very happy to... Our guest is very happy to answer questions. Could I propose that we take them in groups of, say, three? Would that be appropriate?
Sure.
Okay. So let's go from there. One, two, three.
Hello. My name is Howard Mullett, and I work with the UK Network of Development NGOs, BOND. I have three questions, but they're linked, and I'll be very brief. The first is, does Mr. McShane believe that the IGC will finish on deadline because treaty watchers are sceptical? The second is, will Mr. McShane and the UK government push for a hasty finish to the IGC with so many contentious issues unresolved to date? And then before the third, quickly, as I've said, there are the treaty proposals include many the proposals that are still being debated include many aspects which have yet to be resolved, with massive substantive policy implications. But as we've seen in the media and when politicians talk about the treaty, it's the big spats over a federal Europe or an intergovernmental Europe that catches all the headlines. Development NGOs have welcomed the pledges to focus EU development policy on poverty reduction and human rights, but we're concerned that these are undermined by proposals which seek to subordinate development aid and humanitarian aid to new foreign policy at the EU level, and it talks about humanitarian aid being a tool in the war on terror and so on. So the third question is, how finished will this final product be, the treaty in December, with all of these contentious issues under the so-called non-institutional questions still to be resolved? Might debate on those issues continue into next year?
Right, I think we already have four questions there, so okay. Who are the two down there?
One question, one speaker.
Can we have one question, one speaker, please?
That would be difficult. I would like to ask you why you think that the federal European Union is dead, and what is your vision of the institutional shape of a new Europe in general, and in the area of foreign policy in particular. And I would like to ask you for the limits. Where do you think the new Europe will stop geographically?
Blake Evans-Pritchard from the EU Observer. Just a quick question about the referendum, or the fact that the UK government is not planning on having a referendum. How do you respond to what people say that, you were talking about the fact that in general European citizens are behind the EU, but how do you respond to the fact that in every country in recent years that has had a referendum on the EU, they've initially sided with the sceptical side? I'm talking like Denmark, Ireland, Sweden.
Right. Will the IGC finish in December? I certainly hope so, but I can't guarantee that. It requires a spirit of compromise by all 25 independent sovereign member states. My feeling is that people are tired, because, Carl, you're obviously right, and we can keep on debating this for the next 20 years. We've been debating European constitutional issues really non-stop since Maastricht. And of course, everybody comes along with their own a set of issues that they think is profoundly important. And I mean no disrespect. And business groups have got one set of issues, people representing different pressure groups, all of them wholly legitimate, have got other issues they want to have raised. You mentioned development aid. That's profoundly important. I think it's to Europe's credit. We spend 2.5 times as much development aid as does the United States. And we've got a very, very good record, but I doubt if I'll be able to satisfy every one of the coalition of development aid organisations' legitimate demands. But that's the point. You can't transfer to Brussels and the European Constitutional Treaty the hopes and aspirations you want to see instantly realised yourself. You've got to keep lobbying, and in fact Britain on Development Aid Jubilee 2000, Trade Justice Movement, has got a fantastically good tradition. But Europe, I think, creates a wider space now, a much wider political and economic and geographic space, to make this pan-European movement. I mean, there are sensitive things. I mean, Britain's got an incredibly strong record, I think, on animal protection. The Royal Society, RSPCA, gets far more money than all the charities that campaign for children's protection. I have friends in Spain who assure me that Britain will not be a full European country until we allow bullfighting in Hyde Park. I think they may have a weight, but I don't think it's up to me to try and campaign in Brussels to get bullfighting banned. On the geographical expansion of Europe, well, I think De Gaulle put it reasonably well, Atlantic to the Urals. That's a reasonable, workable definition. On the question of federalism and so forth, as I said, that I think people want to move away from a Jacobin Europe, that's to say a centralized Europe. And I think sometimes, unfortunately, the word federal in English, people really mean centralized or Jacobin, that's to say all power to a Hegelian state idea of Europe. And I think that's the one that's going more and more out of the window, even if I may say so, in France. On the question of, it's not on.
Is that on?
So I just got to get a little closer. Sorry. On the question of referendums, there have been referendums up and down on Europe for a number of years. Some say yes, some say no to aspects of European construction. I think they're salutary warning shots. I think the real referendums that count are general elections. You should never forget the old Israeli saying that people always tell the truth to opinion polls and always tell lies when they come to vote. So we should just deal with that. But the fundamental issue for our country remains. Each country's got different traditions. Belgium and Germany can't have referendums under their constitution. Ireland and Denmark must have referendums under their constitution. The real question for me on this issue here is, do we uphold parliamentary traditions of dealing with treaty legislation, or don't we? I think that's the kind of fundamental question. I'm afraid I've got a vested interest. I'm a boring old MP. I think long live the parliamentary road. Served us quite well for the last few centuries.
Okay, there's a one, two, three.
I'm a continental living in this country. And
which country?
From which country?
Yeah.
I live in Britain,
yeah.
But I come from Italy. And I wanted to ask you, referring to the comparison you made about the growth in the United States in Europe. Recently here in London, Mr. Padoa-Schioppa, who's member of the board of the European Central Bank, underlined how if you take the past 10 years and you compare the US and Europe and you take away the demographic growth, the difference in terms of economic growth is much smaller than it seems. And if you calculate, in fact, the GDP growth for our work, it has been higher in Europe than in US, simply because in Europe there has been a trend in decreasing the numbers of our work and because we have more holidays. So, I mean, I don't think it's a success. It's so clear that the U.S. Is a success in terms of economic development. Some economists also argued that if you take that in the United States there are about 2% of the population in prisons. And if you would bring this percentage down to the European level, you would have a higher unemployment in the States than in Europe. So I wonder if we would really, if we are really sure that they are performing much better than us. And the problem is that GDP is a very imperfect measure of quality of life. If this country would use the bicycle as in the Netherlands, the GDP would fall just because the consumption of petrol would decrease, but the quality of life would increase enormously. So I'm just asking, I mean, are you really sure that this sort of aero-pessimism does make sense? Sorry for the length of the question.
Okay, good evening, Minister. The Three Musketeers trip to Tehran, that clearly shows that the colonial Europe now understands that reshaping the new world is a must for you, your safety, as well as people living in Oval Office safety. So, is the Scandinavians, is it the austerity measure, or they went to Tehran ahead of you? What is wrong in taking them? Because, the world you want to dominate in the Europe. Why are you? What is wrong in taking a Scandinavian or somebody from Portugal or somebody to Tehran? That shows that you treat your people equally. Number two, see, you always want to talk, compare yourself with Americans. Have you got any good news for immigrants? I mean, in French, it's Algerians still suffer. Germans, they don't bother about Turkish giving you passport. Look at me. I don't get good training. I don't give, see, can't you give me a green card? You are giving me, what is it? So, why don't you have a, we will also help with you to shape not only the world, if the Europe is, new world is, new Europe is yours, the new world is ours. Thank you. Your socks clearly show you are faithful to the party. Thank you.
And the third question there.
Thank you, Minister. My question is simple. You briefly mentioned the enlargement of the European Union. What is the biggest challenge of Great Britain after the enlargement of the European Union in 2004?
Okay. In a sense, all three questions come together. I love this notion that Europe is much richer than America. There's no unemployment, no poverty, no difference. Sicily and the Mezzogiorno is flowing with milk and honey. That Mr. Berlusconi presides over a kind of paradise of social justice, equality, redistribution. Well, I have to say, if a governor from an Italian bank seriously thinks that America is doing poor, a European Central Bank, is that America is doing terribly badly and Europe's doing terribly well, then, you know, for the first time in my life, I'm really worried. Because economics, they're just there. Just think of the patent registrations, think of the new companies. Quality of life for hundreds of millions of, or scores of millions of Americans is actually very, very good. Try Seattle, try San Francisco. The United States in the last 10 years has accepted about 10 or 11 million legal immigrants and probably 30 million so-called undocumented, what we call sans-papiers in French, or illegal immigrants here. And all of them, not all of them, but many of them have got jobs and a new start in life. And their children will be, thanks to the money invested in American universities, the kids leaving with all the new PhDs. You look at the trouble we have, and that's your point, sir, with the question of immigration and asylum seekers. And the biggest challenge for Europe, to come to your point at the end, is precisely what I am arguing. In Brechtian terms, erst das Fressen, dann kommt die Moral. You begin with putting food, that's to say work and shelter and jobs and a real terre-à-terre material existence for Europeans, and then you can get into great political, superstructural, redistributive debates. He said, of course I'd love everybody in America to be on a bicycle, a bit difficult to get from Boston to Washington, but you know, it'll be worth the effort to see Dick Cheney on one. But it's but the plain fact is that in Seattle, a city I know quite well, I mean, all the cops there seem to walk around with very nifty shorts on bikes, and are in the streets. It'd be nice to see some cops in the streets in the odd city of Europe or Britain. So America is complex, but we will not build, and this is a point Lucien Febvre, I really recommend the essay, the lectures he gave to the Collège de France just after liberation in 44-45. He said, Europe should not seek to define itself by the other. And I have to say that I worry considerably that the Europe of slow growth, that then actually seeks to justify itself with statistical leisure de main, is not an intellectually coherent Europe. And that is why I think that notion of responsible and sustainable economic growth that provides a fiscal receipts for social Europe, environmental Europe, cultural Europe, is the right way forward. But please do not let us live in a world in which we will not face that reality that Europe is not meeting the challenges it needs to meet to serve the needs of its citizens. Maybe they are in Italy.
Your question about...
Well, it was the challenge of the IGC is obviously to make enlargement work. It is a big challenge. How, in a sense, do we ensure that Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, the Baltic states, etc., discharge their own needs and responsibilities to their citizens. I think we've managed this in past enlargements, but it's a much bigger one to deal with. When I travel in those countries, I think in particular their cities are doing very well. I meet a younger generation of political people, media people, intellectuals, academics, government people who want to raise their countries to a very high European standard. But the best way of doing that, and we can absorb, for example, a lot of people movement much better if we've got performing economic growth. A lot of the new American job creation has come in retail sector, finance sector, leisure sector. Those are the areas where there's still very big blockages in Europe. But Europe's moving. Schroeder is pushing through reforms. France, I don't know if you've read its so-called declinist literature. It's produced a very neuralgic response from some of the French leadership. I remember in the 1980s, the good, solid, left-wing Labour trade unionists saying that Britain had no problems. This was all just, you can always find economic statistics if only all the people were released, counted in British prisons, British unemployment would go down. I mean, these are ridiculous arguments, but they are at least being seriously addressed. And we need to give maximum support to our friends in Germany and other countries that are adopting the reform road.
Three more. The question over there, and one over there somewhere. Okay.
Good evening, Minister. My name is Shara Ali. I'm a European candidate for the Green Party. Isn't it typical of the Conservative Party, New Labour, I always get this mixed up, isn't it typical of New Labour that you desire to measure success in terms of very narrow economic indicators? For example, in your talk, you seem determined to relate UK educational excellence to endowment funding or professorial salaries relative to the US. And when you speak of the knowledge economy, it's very clear that what's doing the work isn't the overcoming of, but the cash value of a qualification on the job market.
Why don't we take the other two first?
Giacomo Benedetto, Department of Government. You mentioned reform of the agricultural policy as a case where Britain supports reform, where active engagement of Britain in the European Union could produce results if only we could achieve, presumably, the unanimous consensus required to reform the CAP. The draft constitution proposed shifting all of the areas of compulsory expenditure within the budgetary procedure over to the current decision-making process, more or less, that exists for non-compulsory expenditure. That's to say, if the draft constitution had been adopted unamended, the EU budget would have been decided largely by qualified majority votes, with the opportunity for the European Parliament to propose amendments. ECOFIN, within the last week or two, has unpicked that, and I wonder if you care to comment.
Thanks. Well, my name is Carlos, I'm a PhD student here at LSE. It's a very direct question, but as Spanish, I need to do it, from your speech, I assume that the UK government is working to end with the terrible situation in Nicosia, the last divided capital in Europe. My question is the UK government doing something to end with the last colonial territory in Europe, namely Gibraltar? Don't you think that this is a senseless situation between two EU countries in the 21st century? Thanks.
Sorry you think that allowing more universities to develop more facilities to a better teaching facilities, higher paid professors and lecturers, more chances to stretch out and develop new theoretical work is about adding cash value. I mean, I simply don't. I mean, we just have to agree to disagree. Jack, on cap reform and ECO FIN. I mean, CAP actually technically is dealt with under QMV at the moment. The trouble is there isn't a majority in Europe because too many countries have got a big stake in CAP, which is why the Irish proposal to decouple is actually very, very interesting. What I'd argue, and I argue consistently, is that in Britain we've got a large consensus on CAP. I expect UKIP and the Green Party and Labour and Tories and Trotskyists and Liberals and the Daily Mail and the Guardian would all be agreed. Oxfam, the churches, CBI would all be agreed on CAP's a terrible thing. But I consistently argue there's no use talking to each other about it. We have to make the case in French or Spanish. It's my joke about, which I noticed nobody laughed at, I think I'm going to take that out of the next speech, about learning to speak Volapük. This is General de Gaulle said of the United Nations and Brussels that these were ridiculous institutions. The only authority for power was the state. And these were places where they spoke Volapük, in other words, a kind of meaningless babble of international speak. On the contrary, forging international rule of law would be incredibly difficult. Frankly, it's a centuries-long project. It's the next great stage, I think, of development of civilization. Estoy totalmente de acuerdo que la cuestión de Gibraltar es absurdo. Que entre una nación de 40 millones y una nación de 60 millones, que el argumentito sobre un pequeño rincón de Europa con 25 mil habitantes, que es importante para Madrid, es totalmente... es muy importante para Madrid, por el español. What would you like? Do you want me to translate that into German? What I'm saying is, it is absolutely ridiculous that anybody quarrels over Gibraltar. Gibraltar has got 25,000 people, Spain's got 40 million, we've got 60 million, let Gibraltar be Gibraltar. And if they want to stay British, let them stay British. It is frankly ridiculous to turn this into any kind of a quarrel. And when Adolfo Suarez, the first Prime Minister of Democratic Spain after Franco died, came to see Jim Callaghan, he raised the question of Gibraltar. Jim said to him, We have a good English expression. It says you can catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. And yo creo que existe exactamente la misma expresión en español. Puede atrapar más moscas con miel que con aceite. In other words, if in the last 25 years Gibraltar had just been left to get on calmly with its way of life, I think by now we'd be in a completely different situation. But if you keep pushing, then I'm afraid, British people will push back. And we've got so many good things we're doing with Spain. To make Gibraltar endlessly the stumbling block, I just honestly don't understand. I've said that to Spanish colleagues, I've said that on the record, I'll be saying it now. Different bits of Europe will have their own historical anomalous situations, and I think we should just be much more relaxed about it. Do you want to take some questions from there?
Three questions, yes. The gentleman with the microphone, one, and one from up there, and the lady at the front here. Okay. You have the microphone first, and then up there, and then the lady at the front.
Hi, I'm not from Europe. But when we study Europe back home in Canada, one of the big things that we always read about in the literature is the supposed democratic deficit around the table between leaders in the European Union. So as someone who often sits around the table, I'd be interested in hearing your opinion on how egalitarian the decision-making process is in those negotiations.
The issue of progress and development aid was mentioned before.
Can you put the microphone closer to your face, please?
Yes.
And turn it on, perhaps. It doesn't sound as if it's on.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay. So the issue of development cooperation was mentioned before, and you replied that Europe actually devotes a significant chunk of its GNI to it. But actually, some of the criticisms address bureaucratic overlappings between Europe and the member countries, etc. Do you think these issues are actually being tackled? And what do you foresee as the
development and aid cooperation scenario in the new Europe?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Yeah. you mentioned, I'm sorry. You mentioned the EU enlargement before in your lecture, and it was also mentioned in the question time just now. What I was wondering is, what is the current UK's government's involvement in preparing those countries that will soon be in the EU and those countries that are in the accession negotiations at the moment for actually being able to apply the acquis communautaire in their actual countries? For example, what's the UK's government in actually helping those countries in institution building, educational policy, which you mentioned before is key to Europe's role in the world at the moment? What is the current Labour government doing to help these countries tackle these issues?
Okay. On the democratic deficit, clearly the European Union is sui generis, and the difficulty is that their relationship between decisions taken at national government level, decisions taken at Brussels, input from the European Parliament, the overlapping of what the Commission does and what the Council of Ministers does, is complex. I mean, I don't deny that for a second. We certainly argue that when the Council of Ministers meets and it is discussing legislative proposals, they should do so in public. One result of that certainly will be, I think, we will get many more set speeches in what are called round tables, table ronde, which are just read out for home consumption. Well, that's a price you may have to pay. I think one of the successes of the EU is that it isn't a UN with just declamatory rhetoric at its this decision-making level. I attend Council of Minister meetings, and they can be very, very intimate, very quick-fire across the table. I don't think that's broadcastable any more than a cabinet meeting in Canada or in Germany or in Britain is broadcastable. Getting that right is difficult. I actually think one of the things the Constitutional Treaty does is to put national parliaments more in the frame, because one of the old ideas of Europe, which I call the Jacobin or federal, in British shorthand you call it federal vision, was somehow Europe would be a Montesquieu 18th century construction in which the European Parliament would replace all national parliaments, the Commission would replace all national governments. That just isn't going to happen. It's because Europe is too complicated, and it's going to be a permanent dialectic between the needs and interests of nation states, and within them, different groups, different regions, different cities, different generations, and what Europe needs to move forward on. And that, in a sense, is also part of my response to the question on development aid. How much should be handed out by Brussels? How much should be left within the national framework? My view is that the British development community is certainly very strongly multilateralist, but also isn't entirely confident that simply signing an entire cheque for billions of pounds to the EU or to any international body guarantees the results that one actually wants. Save the Children and Oxfam and all the CAFOT, what wants to have some relationship with a national aid agency or spending department like DFID. To have some input into those discussions. So again, it's a matter of equilibrium. And the last question also on trade and aid. We actually spend worldwide about $50 billion in aid. We actually spend $350 billion on agricultural subsidies that destroy the chance of much of the poor of the third world to trade normally with us. And that's why I still maintain that the biggest policy goal for Britain after the IGC is over is to get European trade policy right. I think that will do a lot more than fine-tuning, or even what's the opposite of fine-tuning? Big tuning. Aid budgets. But you know, let's be very, very clear. Brazil, under President Lula has just authorized the widespread planting of genetically modified crops. So almost any product soon out of Brazil, as in the rest of Latin America, produced by peasant farmers, fair trade farmers, small scale farmers, is likely to be GMO'd in one way or another. And what the hell are we going to do then, when we abolish the kind of protectionist financial subsidies that distort trade, and up comes another great barrier that says, "Oh, you mustn't trade with these countries because they're using science to improve their crop production." I'm not making a provocative point. I mean, it's a real worry that worries me very considerably, and I just think we should always be thinking through the next stages of some of our policy arguments.
I think a last round of three, and you there. And
these poor people are denied.
Two from the film there, the lady in the front, and one of the two at the back. You can fight each other for the third shot. So if you start now, the lady at the back.
Thank you. Charles Jenkins, Economist Intelligence Unit. Mr. McShane, you say that the draft constitution is more or less a British text, according to Burns, and you seem to approve it. And yet the British have put forward a whole number of amendments for it, whereas the original six countries, I think, don't want any amendments. How is there actually going to get agreement if all the countries other than the original six are putting forward as many amendments as Britain? How are we going to get a quick agreement as you want it?
I would just like to know a bit more about what you think of Prodi's presidency and his impact on the shaping of a new Europe.
And one of the two at the back.
Hi there, one more question on the referendum. If when Parliament comes to debate this in the next couple of years, you have a situation where the House of Lords votes for a referendum, will you then accept that, or will you use the Parliament Act to push it through without a referendum?
The reference to the British Constitution, it was actually Robert Badinter I was quoting, and he was talking about the finished text of Giscard's Convention, and there's a lot in it that we campaigned for, a standing chair of the Council of Ministers and other things. All countries want changes in the text. I mean, please, Charles, don't believe the notion that countries, whether the founding six or the incoming 10, don't want some changes, and that's very, very clear. I took a phone call just before I left my office from one of the founding six Europe ministers asking for changes in the text, and would we agree to that country's proposal? I mean, it's private, so I won't say which one, but everybody is looking at treaty language change to make it stick. Precisely, I think, it answers the third questioner's point, that the anti-Europeans, I mean the souverainists in France, the bossy people, the Flams bloc, all the Trotskyists in France, are all uniting around the call for having a plebiscite on the constitutional treaty, because they know that will give them another 9 months or a year's space of anti-European campaigning. I'm very confident, because actually the House of Lords, to answer your point, the House of Lords committees have done an outstanding scrutiny job on the European constitutional debate. And I would recommend, if you want to write to me, I'll certainly send it to you, the House of Lords European Scrutiny Committee's report that was published at the end of last week. And most of those recognise the very good progress that's been made. I mean, you know, everybody wants some changes. I mean, that's absolutely normal. And I very much hope that the the British Parliament when the final treaty is brought back. I mean, I won't be able to stop those who are anti-European and want to get a quick cheer and a quick fix in the anti-European press. I mean, there's nothing to be done about that. But any rational, decent person who's got our nation's patriotic and best interests at heart will not want to see this treaty ratified, transposed as much as it has to be into British law, and we get on not leaving our friends in Eastern Europe in the lurch as we did 60, 70 years ago, and not sending a signal to the world that Europe just wants to debate its constitutional navel for the next X years. So Mr. Prodi's presidency, I'm an admirer of Romano Prodi, I think we all are. What I would say is that I think it's been very, very difficult to be president of the European Commission in recent years because Europe has not been moving forward. It's not been moving forward particularly economically or politically. In the 1990s, we couldn't move forward on the Balkans. We let Milosevic run riot for almost a decade until, frankly, the Americans were prepared to step in on Bosnia, and Tony Blair was able to show the leadership and the campaign to drive Milosevic's murder machine out of Kosovo. And we haven't been able to adapt to the end of the Cold War, to the reunification of Germany, to the huge new phenomenon of people movement. All of this has caught Europe short. I mean, we were rather complacent, I think, at the end of the 1980s, that the world would carry on as it had been progressing in previous decades. And it's been a long, slow wake-up call. I think it's been very, very hard for Mr. Prodi, for any European president or commissioner, to really get on top of this. That's all I can say. I think he's a good man. I think he's done his best. I think he's been an excellent prime minister for Italy, and I wish him every luck in his future career in whatever direction it takes. But that's a matter for Italian citizens to decide upon.
Well, could I conclude the proceedings by thanking you for your excellent questions, but also thank Dennis for his excellent, robust, energetic answers, and also for the presentation, wide-ranging, I think, overall optimistic, and we thank him for coming to us and giving us his views about the